Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Friday, October 22nd, 2021. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of the book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 17 years to improve the quality of my life and my relationships and turn any negative emotional experience into part of the infallible guidance system that each one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click the link, download it, print it off, and use it as often as you'd like. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness, and you can get access to a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. There are also a host of audio files that you can download and listen to that will serve as a tutorial for you to learn how to apply this powerful tool in all of its magnificent simplicity in a variety of situations in your life. We hope people do that soon and often because it frequently leads to comments and questions. If you have those, give us a call at 563-999-3581 and press 1 and it'll put a question mark by your phone number and I'll announce you by your area code. We're also doing the Course in Miracles workbook lessons this year. Today is the 295th day of the year and today's lesson simply reads, The Holy Spirit looks through me today. The commentary reads, Christ asks that he may use my eyes today and thus redeem the world. He asks this gift that he may offer peace of mind to me and in the process take away all terror and all pain. And as they are removed from me, the dreams that seem to settle on the world are all of a sudden gone. Redemption must be won. As I am saved, the world is saved with me. For all of us must be redeemed together. Fear appears in many forms, yet love is but one. My Father, the Christ mind has asked a gift of me, and one that I give, that it be given back to me. Help me to use the eyes of Christ today, and thus allow the Holy Spirit and its love to bless all things which I may look upon, and his forgiving love may rest on me. Pam Grout has the Course in Miracles Experiment book, and that book lesson titled 295 is titled Donning My Holy Shades. She quotes A Course in Miracles when it says, let go all the trivial things that churn and bubble on the surface of your mind. Pam writes, the Shermans, our neighbors when I was growing up, had three rambunctious boys. Their constant poking and prodding bore a striking resemblance to the antics of the Three Stooges. Whenever the Shermans dared appear in public, let's say in church or at a movie theater, the parents strategically seated one son on the outside, a parent in between, the next son, the other parent, and the last son on the other side. This seating chart saved a lot of problems. I've discovered two words that, like the Sherman boys, are better behaved when separated. These words are I and no, K-N-O-W. When uttered together, the door of further investigation slams shut. These two words are sneaky because isn't that why we were sent to school? Aren't we supposed to know stuff? This lesson reminds us there are more sides to every story. When I and no sit together, an unbelievably powerful force is locked into a tiny little box. When I'm convinced and therefore attached to such stories as, quote, the world is skidding to disaster, close quote, or, quote, so-and-so is such an a-hole, close quote, or, quote, I'm just not good at, insert your own personal nightmare here, close quotes. When that happens, I basically thwart the field of infinite potentiality in its hell-raising anything-goes tracks. Lesson 295, The Spirit Looks Through Me Today, asks me to use different eyes today to refrain from putting the dude or the creation in handcuffs. It tells me that whatever, quote, I know, close quotes, pales in comparison to what's possible when I see it through the eyes of love. So today, look through the eyes of love at everything and everyone you interact with. And as usual, we've got about 50 minutes left to have a conversation. 563-999-3581. Call that number. Press 1. And enlighten us. How would it be useful for us to spend this time today? What's the topic that you'd like to have us go over? What's a question you might have about the worksheet process? 563-999-3581. This week has basically been a week of monologues by me, so we are open and inviting anyone to either suggest a topic or ask a question or refute the usefulness of these tools in preparation for today's podcast. I was going through the Anthony DeMello book, Taking Flight, a book of story meditations. But first, fan mail from some flounder. Area code 520, you're in the air. Who do we have?
Hello. Hello.
Who do we have?
Audrey.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Can you speak up?
Audrey, can you hear me?
Audrey, all right. Your voice is very quiet. I wasn't expecting to hear you because it's been so long. How are you, Audrey?
Well, I'm coming along, but I have a situation that I'd like help with.
All right, and if you can talk directly into the phone, I will try to help you with that.
Okay. Is this any better?
That is better.
Okay, because it's my cell phone. Apologize for my lisp, which is worse because when I had my operation and they took the intubation tube out, so did my front tooth come out. So I went in with one problem and I came out with one problem. The situation I'm dealing with is about letting go. Okay. I have to set this up on what's going on. I live in a senior park, and I have girlfriends. One girlfriend's husband is divorcing her and going out with the other girlfriend. Now, I was in my house laying on the couch, and my one girlfriend came over to visit me. She stayed 10 minutes and left. The other girlfriend, which is right next door, saw that the first one come in. And she came through she didn't knock or anything, and she came through the door, and she started screaming at me and carrying on because I'm friends with both of them. And then she sent, then she left, and then she was texting, I mean, all this vile language, texting, until I finally realized, wait a minute, I could block this. And letting go is, I want to let go of the anger that I feel for the one that was sending me all this vile information and yelling at me. And I want to let it easy for me to say, okay, the process is choose. Just choose to let it go. I haven't been able to yet. So,
okay. All right. So let me offer this much to you. There's a few things here that we come to on a regular basis with this work. And one of them is whenever there's anger coming out of a person, it means whoever that person is, it means that there's pain, fear, or sadness inside that person. And this will only always and forever be the case with human beings. So when you have trouble letting go of the anger, it means there's pain, fear, or sadness in you. When you were experiencing anger from somebody else, it means there was pain, fear, or sadness in that person. So that's where I would begin. In this work, the primary tool is the reality management worksheet. And so if you take it out and you start saying, I, Audrey, who am love, am feeling anger, and you work through that worksheet, you're going to get one level of information and revelation about your own internal processing. However, mm-hmm. to facilitate that process, you might want to say, all right, let me just take a breath. I'm feeling all this anger. I wonder, since I know that there's always pain, fear, or sadness underneath anger, I wonder which of those three, pain, fear, or sadness, is more strongly resonant for me right now. And then when I decide which one it is, maybe I'm afraid that this person who sends all of this nasty stuff and vitriol is going to take action and attack me in person or turn my other friends against me or whatever the fear might be. Maybe when I start doing the worksheets on that process related to fear, it'll resolve quicker. Maybe it's sadness. Maybe I'm trying to avoid, you know, with the energy of anger, I'm trying to avoid the sadness of realizing that this friendship is lost. Because anybody who could send me that level of angry, bitter messaging is not someone that I can maintain a friendship with. So that's the first thing I would suggest is when you go to do worksheets on this, look at the deeper underlying issue. Is it pain or fear or sadness, which will always be there whenever anybody has anger?
Okay.
And the other thing that comes to mind, if that doesn't help you work on it, is Dr. Michael Rice has this, it's a release technique that he steps people through where you imagine the center point in your brain and you create a little open space there or a little altar, and then you hold an image of this friend that you have the anger towards or who had so much anger being expressed towards you, and then you clear your mind, take a few deep breaths, put the focus of your attention there in that center spot of your brain with the image of the person, and then simply ask, you know, out loud, ask Holy Spirit or Rukha Dukucha to help you release whatever attachment you have to that person. And then just take a few deep breaths and repeat that two or three times. Please help me release the attachment I have to this person. And then notice whatever you notice. Is there energy moving in your body? Do you feel trembling? Do you feel hot, cold, light, dark, anyway? And that release practice is extremely valuable to a lot of people. So those are the two things that come to mind to share with you.
Okay. All right. I'll do the inner work. And we learn by contrast. But why is there contrast in this world?
Well, I think that when you ask a question like that, what pops into my mind is that this trying to figure it out is one of our biggest traps as people. So when you ask, why is this happening to me again, not only are you replaying the title of Dr. Michael Rice's book, but if you stay in that, why is this happening, I want to figure this out, you're going to stay trapped. And whatever your conscious logical mind can come up with, it won't be anything as valuable as what insight, intuition, applying a tool to dig at, you know, what is the pain or the fear or sadness in you that's blocking you from just holding compassion for your friend? Yes, the friend that just sent you all of that nasty stuff. Why? Well, because you identified that she's been a friend, and if she's throwing a lot of anger and insult and nastiness at you, that means she's in considerable amount of pain, fear, or sadness.
Yes.
And if you have a friend and you see them in pain, fear, and sadness, what normally gets generated in us is compassion.
Mm-hmm.
So then the process of work in this field, this body of work that we have and do, whether it's Guy Finley's work or Dale Allen Hoffman's or Michael Rice's work, is to uncover what is preventing me from having the experience of this compassion, loving, open energy toward my friend. And you can say, well, because she did this and she did that and she said this nasty thing and she insulted me. And I back up and say, okay, but when we understand that when insults and anger and swear words come out of somebody, what that means is that they are in pain, fear, or sadness. And if I understand that I have a friend who shows up in pain, fear, and sadness, the natural response to that is compassion. So if something's blocking me from having that compassion, I want to do my work to identify it and dismantle it from within my mind-body energy system.
Yes. And as you were talking, I realized, oh my, because she likes to drink. She's an alcoholic. And more times when you see her, she is sober and he is less sober than he's drunk. And my father was an alcoholic. And I grew up with all those nasty words. I mean, I kind of knew words a sailor knew when I was 3 years old. And the text contained a lot of those words. And now I realize this is a lot more, it's deeper than just being angry at her.
It's really deep. Right. This is stirring up traumatic energy, negative beliefs about yourself, memories, wishes for a different kind of relationship with your father, et cetera, that are getting resonated in you when she is acting this way.
Right.
And so, again,
all of this work,
the core of this work is about me. Every time I have a negative emotion, stepping into 100% responsibility for what I'm creating inside of me, which is my emotions. And
mm-hmm.
when I do that and I start applying the tools, what we see over and over again in this work, people that use these tools, is my life starts to get better and better and better. But as long as I'm focused on the other person and what he or she said or did and all of my knowledge about how that's bad, that's wrong, that's not loving, that's not the way you should relate to somebody, as long as all of that mind energy in me is focused on the outside, I stay locked and stuck literally in the prison that's created by my staying focused on somebody else rather than doing my own work internally.
Yeah. And the solution, and I reenact the same dynamics of the anger, the fear, the non-love, and the solution is reenacting or working the worksheet. And it's a case of undoing the illusion of the fear and the anger and dismantling it. So now I know I have to do work. Thank you.
You're entirely welcome.
The only way to do it is to do it.
And deserving.
Okay.
Yeah, and you just had a great, you know, connection between this process that's going on with this friend and your history with your family and your father.
Yes.
And how that might, you know, that might once again prove as a more efficient series of worksheets as it resonates
mm-hmm.
thoughts about your father. Instead of doing worksheets on her and what she said and did, perhaps you just do some on the memories and any associated negative emotions that come easily to mind when you think about your dad.
Right. And when we're not in a body form anymore, but since we all are just awareness and it's energy, but when we're not in a physical body, does those memories still stay with us?
You mean the memories of what we did?
I mean
the
illusion,
our physical
the
world?
Illusional excuse me?
You mean the memories of what we did in the physical form?
Like yelling at my children,
or yelling at my spouse, or
right.
being a drunkard. Are you saying, do those memories
yes.
stay with me?
Yes.
I don't know, but some of the best energies, consciousness, teachers that I've heard talk about it, people like Abraham Hicks and Gangaji and Papaji and things like that, they support the concept that if we do remember it, we have that memory at the same time we have the awareness that it's not important in the big picture. and that all that's truly important is the energetic connection that some would call love, the energy of creation, etc. That kind of stuff, he said, she said, they spanked me, he cheated on me with this other woman, whatever, that all of that stuff that we load into our minds as humans, when we're no longer in the body, we're free to see that that's just soap opera dramas, and that has nothing to do with the flow of life and creation and why we're really here, to extend love, to experience love, to be a part of the flow of life, etc.
Well, thank you very much. Wonderful talking with you, and I'm so glad that this program is here so that when a need arises within me, I have the choice of picking up the phone and calling and expressing what was bothering me. And so now I could work on my answers and have more insight into myself.
Well, you're entirely welcome and deserving. I'm glad it was useful, and it's good to hear your voice after all this time. You sound good.
You.
I hope you're feeling good. And
yes.
I'll mute you so you can listen to the rest of the show.
Thank you.
Blessings. So we've got about 30 minutes left. And Susan, welcome.
Hi, Dr. Tim.
Welcome back.
Good. Thanks. Good comments for Audrey. I'm glad you could hear her well enough. It was a struggle, but it was very good. I wanted to give a report and maybe get some insight on what has happened with my grandson, Jake. After a week of having him live with us, we realized that we were in over our head. I had one incident where actually I had lent our Avicen to a friend, and Michael suggested that Jacob use the Avicen. And so I called my friend and I said, let's go get this machine. Come on with me. He drives with me. We get it. He's very polite to her, very personable, gets in the car, turns to me and says, you led me on. I said, wow. He said, I thought this was a drug run. I thought you were taking me to get some LSD, or I forget what it was he wanted. He takes mushrooms and LSD and all sorts of things. And there was a little envelope connected to the Avicen in which I had put one of the little gloves you use. He thought that envelope had the drugs in it. He tore open the envelope, and when he saw it was just a plastic glove, he stuffed the envelope in his mouth and the glove and started eating them, which showed me how addicted he is and desperate he was to get a fix. And I realized that Tim and I just can't offer him the kind of support and protection that he needed. So I spent a couple of days researching places and found a place in California that takes young people. They have only 5 people in the program. It's residential, minimum stay time, 30 days, and it can go longer. They deal with addiction and mental health problems at the same time. I talked to several people who had been through their program, and they sounded like wonderful young people who had come out the other side and were living productive lives. And each of them were employees now of this. It's a network of centers. And we got it set up. I sent the website and the information to my daughter and her husband, who's a psychologist. even though he's got tremendous problems, he's evidently an excellent therapist and psychologist, and he researched the program and said it sounded really good. In one day's time, they had gotten a ticket from him, and I took him to Philadelphia, and he made it through a stopover in Minneapolis. We were all afraid he wouldn't be able to handle being on his own that much, but he did. He got himself all the way to California, and he's in this program, and he calls. They're allowing him to have his phone. He calls us and says things like, "I'm bored. I hate going to groups, but I think I have to stay here, even though I really want to come home. They've got me in a room with somebody who snores when he's sleeping, and when he's not, he's playing music and shining a flashlight in my face." And his issue is anxiety and insomnia, among others. So we called and made a fuss and got him into another room with another roommate. And in any case, that's the report. My question is, I still have two different sets of people telling me two different things. We have the program, and they are medicating him with all kinds of things and assessing which work and which not. And their objective is to find out, to get his anxiety down to a level where they can work with him on other things. His anxiety is so bad that he literally shakes when he's just supposed to be sitting still, which makes it look like tremors, like detox tremors. So my daughter thinks he's been taking stuff all along, and I don't know. He swears that he hasn't taken anything for 6 weeks, and I haven't found anything. And if I looked, I probably wouldn't. If he's a real addict, he's probably hiding stuff. Anyway, I have the medical people approaching it from the drugs point of view, and then I have one friend who talks to me about what I talked to you about, pans and pandas. And she says, judging from what you've told me about Jacob, it really does sound as if he has PANS, and the longer you wait to get an intervention on that, the worse it gets, which is awfully scary to hear. So here I am just sitting here wondering how I can get palatable information to my son and daughter and daughter-in-law. All of them feel as if I'm, and my ex-son-in-law, they all are on the medical side, and they think the PANS stuff is BS. So I'm just in this dilemma, and I know you're going to remind me that it's my reaction to things that is what we work on here, that I can't fix anything, and I've been doing pretty darn well using the tools. But I wanted to give you an update and hear if you had any thoughts about it that would be helpful.
Well, you're right. I mean, you're the one who's on the phone asking me for support, and you're saying that you're feeling this negative emotion about whatever the outside target is. You're feeling that negative emotion inside yourself. And your thoughts are that it's all about whether or not it's PANS or pandas or meds or nutrition or therapy that could help your grandson. And so one way or another, it's this pattern of thoughts you have focused around, are you able to help your grandson? And if you're generating negative emotions, regardless of the target of the thought, that's what we work on here.
Right.
And, you know, there are all kinds of people who are out there working, and they're working on these things according to the best tools they have and in their own little silo of how they've been educated and the mentors that they resonated with or that they got lucky enough to be exposed to. And the fact of the matter is there are none of them that have the answer that works for everyone. And so this is a very, especially for those of us who have friends or family who are having significant difficulty these days, this is a very big, messy pill to swallow. That the people, the experts, the doctors, all right, the gurus, they don't have all the answers. And so, you know, if I'm stuck having a lot of negative emotions about that, then I might need to do some worksheets around this big existential question. Can I be okay even if I have to live in a world that doesn't have pat answers? Can I learn to live in the question, in the uncertainty, and sometimes the chaos? And there's a, you know, a little bit of history here, because you've done some worksheets in, on the show before, and what's probably happening is that old, deep, unpleasant emotions that you're carrying in you from times when your childhood was chaotic, when there were no pat answers, when there wasn't effective relief from the pain or the fear or the terror of your childhood, they're getting resonated by this. And so because of that, rather than being able to just do your meditation and do your prayer and then get centered, and then when you have some research that seems to offer some fruit to you, then just gently offer it to the family and get to the point where you can be okay even if they don't take your advice. Because then you're focusing on what you have control over, which, again, is one of the biggest things we keep coming back to with this work, is I can only take responsibility for the emotions I'm creating. I can only have some impact on the view of the world that I create inside myself. I can't get other people to talk nicely or follow the medical advice that I think is appropriate, or give up the drugs that I think are hurting them, et cetera. And as I said, that's hard pill for a lot of us to swallow. Go ahead. You feel like what?
It is. I wanted to say, I don't care how much this triggers stuff. I just want him better. Of course, what I'm saying is I have a goal, and it's not being met, and it seems urgent, and I have to be in a hurry. I have to do this yesterday. The fact that this friend who knows about PANS said twice, if you don't catch it early, it gets worse and worse. So a lot of old issues come right in front of my face, like needing to do everything fast. Get to safety as fast as you can. Run like gangbusters.
Right. Just like you did when you were a child, and it was, there was trauma, there was panic, there was physical danger in the house, there was the thing we talked about with the air raid sirens at night with you and your sister, and the things in school about being taught how to duck and cover. You know, to duck and cover in school, because if you see a flash, that means the atomic bomb has gone off, and you know, so that's what I have to, because that's the only thing you can actually have any impact on. That's what I've got to direct you to, is that your sense of panic is not helping your grandson.
Oh, truly it isn't. Right, I know that.
If it was, I'd say, hey, go ahead and throw yourself on the hand grenade, you know,
Yeah, right.
So spend your life to save your grandson. If it would save him, I'd say, yeah, I remember one of the worksheets we did where you said, no, I'm not worried about myself dying. I'm old, but I think our children are going to die a horrible death. Okay, so you're not worried about dying, and so, you know, go ahead. But that's useless, because when you suffer like that, when you put yourself into that chaotic, panicky mindset, it doesn't help your grandson. If it would help him, I'd say, okay, I could understand that. I might choose to do that for my son or their mm-hmm. child. So, you know, if it could help, go right ahead if that's your choice.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. There are many prongs to this, too. Like the issue of trusting, you said the medical profession just doesn't know stuff. Well, that seems awfully dangerous. If I want to feel as if
that's the state of our world.
Yeah. Well, it's a microcosm right now with Jacob with this particular situation. But yes, that is the state of the world. I'd love to hear that working with him in the way they are doing out there, they're being very loving and considerate. And I'd love to believe that this could be the answer too. He doesn't have to get the cure from the PANS angle, that he could get the cure from here. And of course, nobody knows. So maybe he has to go through one whole protocol and then come out the other end either better or not better. And then maybe there'll be enough time, enough residual health that we could take the other path and maybe my kids would listen. I don't know which one is right. I wish they would. These are goals. I hear them. They're all goals. I wish they would listen and consider everything. Why not turn over every single stone, even if it sounds crazy? But that isn't happening. So
right. Yep, and so
keep.
So well, now so you don't have back. To, but you might, and listen to what you're saying here. If you step out of them. Right,
mm-hmm.
This specific, my children as adults dealing with their grandson. If I step out of that, just step back to the broader perspective. What are you talking about? You're talking about parents being flexible, being loving, being willing to just keep trying until something helps their children. Well, you were a child and you had parents that, from your view, didn't do that. And so that's a very powerful goal in you that's resonating all kinds of energies and negative beliefs about yourself that you downloaded when you were a child and your parents weren't pulling out all the stops and being completely open-minded and willing to try anything that would bring relief to their children.
I'd never thought of that, Dr. Tim.
So this is why that goal is so stuck in you.
Mm. Yeah, that really makes sense.
So you might work on some worksheets that have that stated very generally. My goal is that all parents would stay open-minded and try an endless array of things until they found what would bring loving relief to their children. And that could be a worksheet. My thought is these people are stuck, they're being closed-minded, and they're not doing what their child needs. And my goal is
right.
for all parents to stay open-minded and try an endless array of things until they find what brings their child relief. and the emotion in that. You might have one word frustration, another one word sadness, another one word a panicky anxiety. And so there's three different worksheets you could do.
At least, yep. Yeah.
And the other thing is you could go at it with a reality management worksheet, or you could also go at it with a mind shift or something to the effect of, it's safe and healing for me, and I love the challenge it presents me when parents are closed-minded about how to help their children.
Ew. Ooh, I don't like that one, Dr. Tim. Ooh. Yep, that's a good one.
Mm. Well, how good it is would be determined by what gets stirred up as you start to journal about it.
Yeah.
And just let the, you know, what you just said would be the first thing you write on the right side of the piece of paper. Oh, I don't like that one.
Right. Yeah.
So that's where I would direct you.
Okay.
And then all of the above, all of the other stuff we do in here where we recognize that things are always going to work out far better than we fear. You know, if you come to the, you can go back to the last few lessons that we've been doing with Course in Miracles, or you can just go to today's lesson.
It's wonderful.
And it's a little bit more directly stated with Pam Grout's work. The Holy Spirit looks through me today, and it asks me to use different eyes and to refrain from putting creation in handcuffs. It tells me that whatever I think I know pales in comparison to what's possible when I look at the world through the eyes of love. Right? So here's my grandson. I have no idea how this is part of what he needs to go through to learn the next lesson for his personal, physical, spiritual, mental, emotional growth. I don't know. I do know that if I go into panic, it's nowhere near as beneficial for him as if I stay in love, if I am able to do the gentle art of blessing and see him in his highest and best and see his parents in their highest and best, even if I disagree with their approach. And I send that deeply heart-centered, loving energy towards all of them and myself. That's a far more useful application of my mind energy and my emotional energy than being in the panic, especially once I recognize that that panic is probably from my childhood. I probably downloaded this dozens and dozens of times in my childhood.
It boils down to trusting, doesn't it? Just trusting the goodness of the universe. It doesn't have to, I don't have to be right. I don't have to know anything to have things work out for my grandson or anybody else.
That's one different perspective than being in panic and thinking you know what's right. You know, that's the lesson from the Pam Grout work today. Every time I think, I know that this is Pam's and he would be better if they got treatment right away, and I know that if, well, guess what? If I have those two words right next to each other and I have any kind of hostility or fear in my energy system, chances are pretty good I don't know.
Right. Thanks, Dr. Tim. There's so much grasping going on. I can just see my hands tightening over this solution or that solution. You've just shown me a back door where I can back through that door and go away from the scene and not be condemning Jacob or anybody else by doing that.
Well, I hope that helps you back away from the intense negativity, because we know that, you know, among other things, what we do know, what we can observe directly over and over again, is that when I pour negative emotional energy into this stuff, it only gets worse, not better.
Mm.
So I don't know for certain that everything is going to work out. But some of the best, some of the deepest, some of the most profound spiritual teachings over and over again tell me it is.
So at least we can allow not knowing if it's going to be all right and letting that
exactly.
be.
Yes, exactly.
I have a quick question. I know it's unrelated, but it might be related. You were talking about that time in our psychotherapeutic learnings where we went through advocating, expressing rage and anger, and how a textbook was adjusted to and a chapter taken out because that proved to be not the right way to go. So I'm wondering if that could apply. I was working with Mira the other day, and I had no way of knowing where we were going, and there has been a lot of stress building up about Jacob. But I ended up absolutely, totally just screaming, and I was astounded at the amount of energy that was there inside me, and she was too. And my question was, two questions. I thought I had worked through all of that would inspire such an outburst, like primal scream way back when, reparenting, looking at trauma, expressing panic and rage and sadness in a loud way. And here I was doing all that again. And I wondered if it's a bad thing, like expressing rage. Is that just not a good way to deal with it? I know, Michael, and you too, when somebody starts crying, for instance, you say, breathe, breathe. You get the breathing going. And it can feel like an interruption of where we are, but maybe where we are isn't a good place to be and not a healing thing or a healthy thing to stay there for any length of time.
Well, we've been through this round and around. When you hear us say, breathe, you interpret that as us saying, stop crying. And that's not the intention, and that's not what most people, when they do this work consistently, what they experience is, if you breathe, you keep the energy system that processes your emotions open, and you literally experience the emotions more fully and more deeply.
Yeah, I remember
when you hold your breath, when you are choking it back, you lock it down. You don't feel it as directly. You don't give it voice and expression. You don't tell yourself it's okay for me to feel this. And so that's one clarification, is that the intention when we say keep your breath moving is to be able to stay with the emotion and its expression more, not cut it off. And the other thing I would say, the other thing I would say about your question related to what happened when you were working with Mira is, if that erupts as a spontaneous expression, then that's what happens. That's fine. What we're talking about is somebody from the outside imposing a pattern or an exercise that says, here, do this to express your rage. Do it more. Get it out. Feed it. Fuel it. Because essentially what they've discovered with the research is that's all it does, is it feeds and fuels the anger. It does not help resolve it. But if you're in the middle of a process with Mira or somebody else and you have this energy flow through you and it comes out, allow it. Just understand that if it's not being done because somebody told you to and it's not part of an exercise, it's just the flow of the moment. And then see what it has to offer you and continue your processing. You know, I'm not going to say that's bad. You shouldn't scream like that. Oh, if you have that energy in you. You know, here's the 15 commitments of conscious leadership. The third one is I commit to feeling my feelings all the way through, all the way to completion. Once they come, I locate them in my body, and then I move, I breathe, and I vocalize them so that they release all the way through. And as long as it didn't go on for half an hour or 40 minutes of screaming, if it was just a blast of this energy coming out of you and it got vocalized, it might be right in line with what some of the best teachers say to do. When it erupts in you, express it fully. Mm. And if you're like most people, within about 90 seconds to, you know, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, it's going to pass.
Yeah, I
think the intensity will begin to fade.
I think the idea with the anger people is that if they have you start doing puffing and huffing and puffing to get the anger a generator going, they would say we only want to do that because the anger is in there anyway. They wouldn't say you're generating it fresh. This isn't already in you. I'm not arguing for this kind of therapy either, but I think that's what they were thinking, is that it's in there.
Yeah,
this is a way of helping you get it out.
That's right. That's what they were thinking. And depending upon how it's applied and the context, it might be really good for some people. But there is some research that very strongly validates, at least for Harville Hendrix and his people who've been studying this stuff, and they were studying it over the 20-year period that his book had been published and then republished in the 20th anniversary, are encouraging people to say everything negative about their partner is really only fueling the anger. It's not resolved.
Oh, yeah. Right.
So I'm going to end it there so we can start the second hour. Thank you so much for the call. It's always a delight to hear from you. I hope something of what was said is useful and that you check in again on Monday or Tuesday as you feel so moved to let us know how it's working.
Thank you, Dr. Tim. Thanks again, always.
We have an hour coming up of, you know, first hour of the Why Again workshop. I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of this stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. And we'll be back on Monday.
What exists is energy in form. And relative to this integrated energy system that we call a body-mind unit, there are two qualities. There's integrative energy, that which is over on the left side of the board, and disintegrative energy, that which is over here on the right side of the board. Now, we've had the experience over the last 2 years. Our granddaughter came into the world just a little over 2 years ago. And, you know, it was this little baby, little structure, And you know something? She doesn't look like that at all today, 2 years later. And she doesn't look at all like she looked at a month or 2 months or 3 months or 4 months or 5 or 6 or 10 or 20. And what you have to conclude, if you get out of the dullness of incapacitated perception, what you notice is this form is a piece of plastic. It's in a state of becoming. And it becomes according to the energetic patterns in which we engage. If we engage in these things on the right side of the board, hostility and fear, grief, rage, anger, sadness, jealousy, revenge, then we're continuously putting into the cells that are storing that particular energy. And my offering is that every cell in your structure functions as a brain cell, functions to store information. And so we're literally changing the plastic nature of every cell and overall the whole structure of this thing we call a body-mind unit. And we're laying that on top of, you know, we can't just step in, or at least normally, I think we get to a level of power where we might be able to, but we don't just step in and make an instant change in a whole structure. Why? Well, there are 1,000 generations of that mind energy becoming flesh within each of our structures. You know, we don't have to direct its becoming, it's happening. But as we grow in awareness and choose to engage in energetic patterns, we start to direct its becoming. This side of the board, we direct it into the disease process. This side of the board, we direct it into health and wholeness and higher states of being. And if we lived on a planet where 7.5 people woke up every morning, 7.5 billion people, pardon me, woke up every morning realizing that this is who they are, how different would our creative process be? If we didn't have people playing these games, if we weren't playing these games, how different would this piece of plastic look for each of us? What would it be capable of? And as I say, when we engage in that mind energy and it lands on the cell, that mind energy, when it's of a disintegrative nature, the cell says, ouch, it informs us that the quality of our creative process is off base. But what do we do? Well, what our culture has taught most of us to do is blame somebody else for that. Have you ever said this to somebody? You made me really mad. You hurt me. You really have a problem. You ever said that to somebody? And the question I like to ask is, if they're the one with the problem, why are you the one with the pain? That doesn't make any sense. If they're the one with the problem, they'd be the one with the pain. But if you're in pain and you think somebody else has got a problem, you've got a problem. Now, we have a definition for the act of thinking or speaking as though something outside of you is causing what's happening inside of you. And that's called denial. So denial is the act of thinking or speaking as though something outside of us is causing something inside of us to happen. Now, something outside of us can cause something that's inside of us to move or intensify in its movement, but it can't cause that energy to be there. It has to be there in the first place. But when we live in this game of denial, you know, whenever I feel this way, I talk about them or somebody or anybody. What happens is that in order to pretend that my feelings aren't coming from the interaction of my mind energy and my cells, I have to hide that whole process from myself. I literally have to dissociate from that process. And I have to hallucinate, I have to generate a worldview, a perceptual construct that tells me that the problem is really out there. And of course, one of my favorite tongue-in-cheek lines, which many of you have used many times, is, if you've been through it 87 different times with 42 different people, how is it that you're the only one that was there every time? Sooner or later, we have to acknowledge that we're engaged in our own lives. But if we spend our whole lives in denial, You made me mad. You made me sad. You made me angry. You hurt me. That upset me. They disturbed me. Then we have a device called a mind that continuously constructs the world we see as though that was true. And what that means is that the real cause of what we're experiencing, we have to dissociate from. And if you were involved in this work back in the early days, you remember that I used to write on the board, deny, suppress. And it totally changed the work when I was given this instruction. I mean, I had specific instructions that were given internally from Ruka that said, Michael, no, it's not suppress. It's not merely hiding something from yourself. It's locking it away and throwing away the key. Once you're in an arena where you're in denial, you made me mad, your mad is no longer yours to change. So guess what? You now have a life sentence of mad. Anybody and everybody that will can trigger that into activity can seem to make you mad. Why can they make you mad? Because mad is there. And if mad is there, it's an energy. And if you pushed it down 1,000 times, there's a very intense high energy wave radiating out from you that says to all the world on an energetic level, hey world, is there anybody that knows how to make me mad? Have you ever noticed there's never a shortage of volunteers? Why is that? Because life abhors you being diseased. Life doesn't want you dead. So life has been structured, it seems, so that if you are holding to a dis-ease energy and you've dissociated from it, someone's going to show up, and that happens through the law of resonance. Someone is going to receive the energetic invitation to come to your life and do to you exactly what you never wanted to have done. And if you tell them what's wrong with them and you get rid of them and you go away and you take the geographic cure, you'll find somebody else and somebody else and somebody else. I feel so blessed the universe reserved the title of my book for me. Why is this happening to me again? Because virtually everybody in the universe has asked the question. And, you know, probably the greatest atrocity done to us as human beings down through the ages and that we've bought into is that we've had hidden from us the fact that we are by nature creators. Nobody told us that. They told us all kinds of crazy things, but they didn't tell us that through the energetic patterns we engage in, we create our own cellular health and diseases. We create everything that shows up. We literally create the way this piece of plastic called a body-mind unit unfolds and becomes either toward disease or toward health. It depends on what the predominant resonant energy is in your structure. So for people who live in this state of denial, this state where it's all everybody else's fault, they hold all of these causes within themselves, but they press those causes down, hide them from themselves, and by so doing, intensify them every time they have to press it down, and therefore send out a signal that gets even stronger and stronger and stronger. You know, imagine that I've got a 3-foot diameter spring. It sits here on the floor and it stands 3 feet high. Can that spring do anything sitting there on the floor? Not at all. But what happens if I push down on it and lock it? And I push down on it and lock it. And I push down on it and lock it. What happens after years of doing that? And I let the lock off. Whew, a lot of power stored in the spring. If I've been spending years and years and years telling everybody else why they're the problem in my life, I'm pushing down that energy, adding energy and information to it, and by so doing, I'm setting up literally an attractive energy field that will resonate or pull somebody into my life to do it to me again. So when I live life that way, when that's the game that I play, the things that I most don't want to deal with are literally stored in brain cells. When I talk about building brain cells in this work, I'm not talking about building new physical structure. I'm talking about the fact that every cell in the structure is designed to store information, literally to store frequencies. So every cell can hold energetic patterns and therefore function as a brain cell. When there are certain brain cells that I don't want to deal with, things that I'm in denial about, I push those things down and hide them. I intensify them. And by so doing, I set up a high energy wave. Now, I didn't know at the time how important a piece of information this was going to be way back, and this goes back probably 35 or 36 years ago. I used to keynote at a conference called Global Science out in Colorado. And one year, a gentleman named Marcel Vogel came to the conference. Marcel was a 23-year senior scientist from IBM. He was the only non-degreed scientist that IBM ever had on their payroll. And the reason he was non-degreed was because he was self-educated and nobody could teach him anything. At the age of 11, Marcel invented chemical light. You know, you go to a football game and they've got these light sticks and you break the glass tubes inside the plastic and the chemicals mix and they light up. Well, that was Marcel's invention. He invented that at 11. His family didn't have the money. Marcel patented it himself. If your computer works, guess why? Marcel invented the magnetic coating on the plates of your hard drive that allows your hard drive to store information. That's the kind of mind that Marcel had. And what he did this particular year is he brought a thing called a Delaware camera. It was created by a man out of England named George Delaware. This camera is a little different than your average camera. Normally, you click the shutter, the aperture opens, light energy comes in, it's registered on the photographic plate, you develop it, you've got a picture. Not so with the Delaware camera. In between the aperture and the photographic plate, there's a tuning mechanism. So you can literally tune the camera, somewhat like a TV set or a radio, as to what frequencies it receives. And so what Marcel was able to do with this camera was he was able to attune it to the frequency of waves that leave the mind when we think a thought. And what Marcel was able to do was to take pictures of the high energy waves that leave the mind when we think a thought. So whatever we're holding in the way of mind energy within our structures, from our own lives or from our genes, we're literally sending out a composite of frequencies continuously. And because the universe is governed by the law of resonance, now, the law of resonance, simply stated, says this. When two energy systems are in tune or in harmony with each other, there's an interchange of energy between them when one system is amplified above the other. You probably remember from physics class in high school. You took a middle C tuning fork, you hit it on a desk, and you put it in front of a second middle C tuning fork. The second middle C tuning fork was not moving. But when you put the first energized tuning fork in front of it, the second tuning fork started to move. It's called resonance, transfer of information. So notice that this tuning fork is moving, and through resonance, that one starts to move. Resonance creates motion. You might think about let's imagine you've got a baby grand piano, and you have two of them, and you open the top of the two baby grand pianos. Now, there are hundreds and hundreds of keys in each piano. But if I go over to one of those pianos, and I hit the middle C, and I go look into the second piano, there are going to be a bunch of strings vibrating in that second piano. Guess which ones? Only the ones that are keyed to middle C are going to be moving in that second piano. So resonance creates motion. Now, in the human realm, my offering is, resonance adds another piece to the puzzle. And that is, resonance creates motion toward. So, you know, I hit middle C on this piano, the other piano isn't going to get up and crawl up on top of it. It's not going to create motion toward it. But in the human realm, when I set up a frequency, those who are in resonance with that frequency are going to tend to be drawn into my space. And if there's something that I have denied and dissociated from 1,000 times, and it's deeply hidden away in the darkest recesses of my mind, I don't even know it's there, But having pushed it down 1,000 times, it's got a pretty powerful wave coming out of it. Now, if this person has the matching bag of garbage, if this person has the brain cells and the behaviors that match what I've denied and dissociated from, unless they are very conscious, they will tend to be directed by that energy wave. That energy wave will resonate these brain cells in them. Those brain cells will fire, constitute their, what they would call their conscious thought and behavior, and they're going to tend to do a behavior toward us. Guess what the behavior is likely going to be? Let's see if that's true. Has anybody ever gone into somebody's space totally committed to being loving, nurturing and caring, and all of a sudden found yourself functioning like a mad banshee? What happened? Well, here's my offering. You went in totally committed to being loving and nurturing and caring, but their high energy wave set something else in motion in you. It resonated your mad banshee. And when your mad banshee started to move, that took over your behavior, and there you were doing it to them again. That's how the why is this happening to me again principle occurs. And guess what? Even if you didn't do it, they're going to see you do it. Well, Michael, that doesn't make any sense. Oh, yeah, it does when you know how the mind operates. Because here's what's going to happen. When they do that behavior, when they bounce off of that high energy wave in you and do that behavior, they're going to resonate those very brain cells that you've denied and dissociated from. When those brain cells start to fire, they're going to create a perceptual construct that will be projected from those brain cells, and you're going to show up in their mind. Literally, they will see a body that they call you in their mind with and made up of the threads of energy of what you've denied and dissociated from. So they're going to show up in your mind with your problem attached. You're going to see that it's their problem. It's going to be really clear to you. But then notice you've been through it 87 different times with 42 different people, and you're the only one that was there every time. This is an internal process that comes about as a result of denial and dissociation. So what happens when we deny and dissociate, this is the energetic pattern that occurs. And then when those brain cells fire, and we live in a culture, you know, psychology tends to tell us that projection is taking something that's inside of you and putting it outside of you. That's not projection. That's externalization. Projection is when I take brain cells I've denied and dissociated from, and I generate perception out of it. I generate the picture world that I see. Now, it's interesting, and of course, we've been teaching this for decades, but a couple of years ago, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 years ago now, we came across some research that was done by the CIA. If you go to CIA.gov, you can download a book. God knows how many taxpayer dollars they spent on it. It was called The Study of Human Intelligence. And there's a chapter in it on perception. They're studying how perception works. And here's their bottom line conclusion. You can go to the CIA website and download this book free. What it says is, the mind does not record reality. The mind generates reality. This perceptual world, the world that you see, is a generated world. And as a generated world, it is a construct of your mind. And until you interrupt what's at the root of the way your mind constructs the world that you see, you will tend to be stuck in this pattern of denial, dissociation, and then projection. Now, our culture tells us that we have a pair of windows that we all get to look out of and see what's going on in the world. That is probably the biggest lie you've ever been told. You do not have a set of windows that look out into the world. It's not possible. You have an antenna. It's called the eye. It's a frequency receiving device. It receives frequencies based in light energy. Light energy enters the eye, and through the law of resonance, the information that comes in through the eye resonates brain cells. And brain cells generate perception, the world you see. You can't look out through this antenna. All the eye is, as the other senses are simply frequency receivers. They're just receivers of energy. And whatever energy you have brain cells for, whatever brain cells it resonates in you, the brain, the mind, distinguish between those two because the mind functions through every cell in the body, the mind generates this perception. And it's interesting, there's some Harvard research that says that in a time frame where 10,000 brain cells fire, that is, there are 10,000 measurable units of electrical activity going on within this structure, in that time frame, which is about a 25th of a second, the max amount of data that goes into building your perceptual world is 9 bits. That's it. You get to see 9 bits out of 10,000 brain cells firing. And it's been estimated that the actuality of the world perhaps contains as much as 20 trillion bits in that same time frame. So we're looking at a tiny, tiny fragment of what's actually happening in the world and a tiny fragment of what's going on within our minds. Now, when you get down to that, what you call this sort of a device is an evidential device. When you're only looking at 9 bits of data out of 10,000 brain cells firing, you're looking at evidence. There are no facts there. There is only evidence. And there's a device, or there's a function of the mind called a bias. And, you know, in electronics, if you've got a, let's say you want to, you've got a transistor, and that transistor is designed to pass a certain frequency. You have to apply a voltage to it that allows that to pass. Well, it's pretty much the same here. You have to apply a willingness to have certain evidence present itself. And so that bias that is what's contained in literally our whole generational pattern. And as a result, the only evidence we ever get to see is evidence of our own BS. And of course, that's a belief system. Anybody else have a different reality for those initials? If you have a different reality for those initials, I'll invite you to notice that's your reality. It's not mine. It's a belief system. I've had people who got, you know, upset with me for writing the initials BS on the board. And notice that they weren't upset because of my meaning, my reality, my perceptual construct for BS, belief system. They were upset and disturbed by a perceptual construct in their minds for those initials. Yeah. All upset is internal. You can't be upset unless you have an upsetting energy within yourself. And if you live in denial, they upset me, then dissociating from that upset, you will project it into your brain's image of someone else, and, you know, an endless procession of people will show up being the problem in your life. But you're the only one that was there every time. And when you understand that, these eyes don't see out there, but the world you see is generated from the firing of brain cells within you. Dr. Tim introduced a video by a gentleman, and take a look on, you know, you can go into YouTube and search for Anil Seth, A-N-I-L-S-E-T-H. And he does a beautiful presentation where he informs us that the brain doesn't see light and the brain doesn't hear sounds. No such thing happens. The brain, the perceptual system, is constantly making its best guess about what's going on out there. When you realize that's how your perceptual system works, then, and you realize that perception has a quality, you got to have a standard by which to measure the perceptions you're going to accept and the ones you aren't. There is a sign within your structure that will tell you 100% of the time when your perception is off base. And that is your perception fueled by either hostility or fear? Ever asked you earlier, did anybody ever accuse you of doing something you've never done or saying something you've never said? You know, most everybody in an audience will raise their hand, you know, kind of a laugh. Yeah, I sure have. Take a moment and think about any time in your life where somebody's done that kind of accusation and they were not correct. What state of mind were they in when they accused you of saying something you never said and doing something you never did, even though they swear they saw you do it? I guarantee it's always hostility and fear.
Yep.
Now, probably that makes sense to you when you're looking at other people, but notice that you still have a tendency to trust your mind when it's doing hostility and fear. Hostility and fear are indicators that the mind is using corrupt data to build the world that you see. If you come from generations and generations and generations of hostility and fear-based perception, then it seems like that's the only thing possible is perceptions based in that. But the mind does not record reality. The mind generates reality. If your mind is generating your reality out of hostility or fear, and remember, this is reality. The perceptual output of the mind is your reality. And what's going on in the world, this 20 trillion bit world, is actuality. When you can let the actuality come in and teach you, well, what are you going to have to do to be able to do that? You're going to have to make a space for it to happen. You're going to have to collapse this projection. Guess what forgiveness does? Is forgiveness about letting other people off the hook because pain or trauma is moving in you? Forget it. Never forgive anybody for anything. And many people say, oh, yeah, that's right. I have to forgive myself. Never forgive yourself for anything because you can't. It's not possible. What the Greeks taught us was to let other people off the hook. They taught us pardoning in place of forgiveness and totally bastardized the idea of forgiveness. Forgiveness is the tool with which you collapse perceptions based in hostility and fear, and you leave a clean and open space within your mind for something based in active love to come forward. And when that happens, then what enters into and what fuels the human mind is this state of being that we are designed to function out of. And this physiological device becomes a home where love is incarnated and embodied, and it fuels absolutely everything. So the key tool that's needed, if you recognize that your life has any given arenas, you know, it might be in the arena of relationships or money or business or work or employees, whatever arena it's in, if you find yourself, your mind producing hostility and fear, your job, should you choose to accept it, is to weaken those frequencies of hostility and fear until they can no longer take over your perceptual system. Now, each of us has an innate tendency to perceive life in a certain way. That's because we have generational patterns. Remember we talked about there's integrative energy, there's disintegrative energy. Interesting, in the Aramaic language, the word that describes disintegrative energy is sin. It's an interesting word in Aramaic. The word sin has nothing to do with some terrible, awful thing that you've done. The word sin in Aramaic is actually an archery term. When you picked up the bow and arrow and you fired at the bullseye and you missed the bullseye, the scorekeeper yelled sin. All it means is you're off the mark. That's all it means. And if I put an energy that's off the mark, some form of hostility or fear, into a cell, I begin the degradation of that cell. Now let's go back to the Aramaic way where they informed us the wages of sin is death. Now I can remember being a kid and thinking, oh, God's going to get me for my sins. That was what I was taught. You're going to be punished for your sins. And here we live on the punishment plan. How common is that belief? What if we lived on a planet where 7.5 billion people could not even conceive of punishment, let alone reach out in punishment? What if we had 7.5 people who simply functioned as love and punishment never entered their awareness in any way, shape, or form? How different would our world be? I'm offering a worldview that's possible, and that's where we want to go with this work. So when they say the wages of sin is death, all they were saying is, if you put disintegrative energy on top of disintegrative energy on top of, on top of, on top of, you're going to die. Your structure isn't going to be able to carry that burden. Literally, mind energy becoming flesh, that chemistry that we call it, that lands inside the cell, is going to create deterioration of the cell. You get enough cells deteriorating, you get an organ system failing. You get enough organ systems failing, and you die. Life can't be supported in a system that is filled with sin. And it's got no connotation of, you know, evil, bad, wrong, nasty. It's just, what quality of energy are you engaging in? And then you remember they said, the sins of the fathers will be passed, yea, unto 3 and 4 generations. This is straight out of scripture, and guess what? It's got nothing to do with religion. It's just the way the system works. It's interesting. I came across this morning some emails from a friend from several years ago, and I'd sent him some of the material and the Beatitudes and the Kabbalah's manuscript, and he passed it on to a business acquaintance. And I just read it this morning, and this fellow is Jewish, and he was putting forward some of Yeshua's ideas in Aramaic, these kinds of ideas. And this guy, this executive from a company he was working with, sent back, he says, what, you and Jew are talking about Jesus? I'm going to have to sit down and have a few shots of tequila before I read this. Because our world's been brainwashed that this is about religion. And that's just another scam to keep people separated and finding somebody else at fault and not living as their true nature. What this man said is, this is what causes you to die. And you have generations of that in there. Who told you that literally, I mean, you go back 4 generations, and that's 31 lives. Who told you that you have every thought, every feeling, every reality structured within your structure of the previous 30 people in your generations? Did anybody tell you that? The thoughts, the feelings, the attitudes, the perceptual constructs of mom and dad, and mom and dad's mom and dad, and their moms? Did anybody tell you that? This book called Scripture is not about theology. Here's where it's about genetics. It's about physics. It's about physiology. It's about psychology. It's about how this energy system called life works. But the Greeks didn't want us to know that. You'll notice the Greeks, you know, they had these gods that raped their own mothers, murdered their own children. Pretty heavy-duty group of folks. So through that filter came this insane interpretation of something was just meant to help you to determine how to live your life. So if you've got generations of energies that are off the mark in there, you're in trouble. And of course, you think about 3 to 4 generations, and where did the previous fourth generation back get their thoughts, their feelings, their realities? But from the previous generation and the previous. And so what this work ultimately is inviting you to do, and I'll say that having developed this and worked with this for almost 50 years now, when people are first introduced to this, they get it on a certain level. But it isn't until people work with it for 5 to 10 years that they really grasp what it's about, what it really means. And what we're inviting each of you to do is to develop a skill unheard of in our culture. And that is the skill of being able to delve inside of your own energy system, to learn to collapse projections of untoward energies, move into and literally decode what's in the cell. Literally, that mind energy comes in, lands on a receptor site, is integrated in the cell. The skill is to pull that out of the cell and throw it away. That's forgiveness. And to be able to literally develop the skill to go down to the point where you literally are sensitive enough to the energies contained within your structure that you can go back into the generational patterns and pull the neuropeptides out of the genes that create that pattern, that create this inclination that's activated in certain ways in your life. So we're inviting you to develop a set of skills. And it doesn't happen on day one or day two or day 10 or day 20. You know, I have people like, you know, oh, I got $5 in 5 minutes. Tell me everything you know, Michael. No, that's not how it works. I use an example of that. And I say this by way of hopefully inspiring you to really take. I'm suggesting you do at least 2 worksheets a day in each assignment as they come, as we go through this intensive. And if you do, through the period of the 14 weeks, you'll integrate it into your life as a habit, and it will become yours for life. That's one of the benefits of doing this intensive this way, as opposed to people coming to Heartland for 16 days and doing it all, but then taking it back to their lives and trying to integrate it into their daily lives. It's a challenge. But ultimately, what we're inviting you to do is to develop the skills of being able to go into the deepest parts of your structure, access what's there and what doesn't belong, to literally be able to throw it away, to remove it. And what does that look like? What are we capable of? And I use an example. Michael J., my son, is a computer nerd. And when he was about 15, he decided he wanted to learn about computers. And I had a student friend in Kansas City who was a former NASA computer scientist. And he's someone that I've worked with for several years. He'd done my work, and we just became buds over the years. And so I called Graham and I said, hey, Michael J. wants to learn about computers, and I know you've got a computer school aside from about 4 computer businesses. Can Michael come and work with you? He said, sure. And Michael J., of course, was raised at Heartland. And thank you to Fran Tyner, because Fran was this the first 2 or 3 years that we were at Heartland, and Michael J. was, you know, I guess he was about 8 or 9, and he became Fran's tail. He went everywhere Fran went, and Fran would just had this ability to do anything with his hands. So Michael learned that skill from him. And so he ended up going and living at Graham's home and doing kind of an exchange with him for room and board while he was going to school and studying computers. Actually, over a period of a couple of years, when Michael J.'s stereo system left the house, we knew he'd gone to Kansas City, and that was it. But I tell the story because there was a point where I had bought a new computer. And when I got that computer up and running, got it online, you know, this is back when you push the button, it went beep, 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 all these tones, and you got this crawling thing that happened. Well, it didn't work properly. So I called the company, and I don't know, I spent 2, 3, 4, 5 hours on with technical support. They couldn't get the computer working. So I said, well, pack it up and send it back to us. We'll fix it. So I packed it up, sent it back to them. 2 weeks later, I got the computer back. It's ostensibly fixed. I plug it in. Same problem. Exact same thing. So I got on the phone with the computer with tech support again, go through the whole routine. They can't get it working. So I don't bug Graham because he's a really busy guy. He's got 3 or 4 businesses. And so I picked up the phone and I called and said, Graham, I apologize for bugging you, but I got a problem. Can you help me? And so I explained what had happened, and, you know, I sent the computer back and they couldn't fix it. And, you know, what do I do? It's a brand new computer. He says, okay, well, go to a C prompt. At that point, I was a little bit ignorant of computers. I said, what's a C prompt? And I followed his directions. He said, well, put in a string of letters and hit a return. So I put in a string of letters, hit a return. Read to me what it says. And I read it to him. And he says, okay, type in this string of characters and hit a return. Read from what it says. So I put that in, hit a return, and I read it to him. He says, okay, your computer's fixed. What? Your computer's fixed. Oh, now come on, Graham. I mean, I sent it back to them. We've spent hours on the phone. Michael, your computer is fixed. Guess what? My computer was fixed. Now, the company that built the system couldn't troubleshoot what Graham did literally in 3 minutes on the phone. That's called having brain cells for something. Are there challenges in your life? Are there hostilities and fears that you can't seem to overcome? Are there disorders and diseases that just don't seem resolvable? Well, as I said, 5 to 10 years of engaging. And people say, well, that's a long time. I don't know if I want to. Well, what else is there to do? There is no other path to this end result than doing your work. You know, in the ancient times, they wanted an instant fix too. Well, $5, 5 minutes. What did they say to them? You can't storm the gates. You can't do it. It takes doing your work. You have this body-mind unit. There are generations and generations and generations of untoward energies in there. And you've just got to clean it up. Now, I've spent the last half century studying how to do that, how it works, what that all means. And this is my end result. It was actually the thing that inspired me to take it to the next level. My son just turned 40. Was his birth. And when he came into the world, it was just like so awesome and delivered him, or caught him with my hands. And it was just so amazing. And then I looked at the world at that time, and it's like, well, if somebody doesn't do something, there isn't going to be a world for this little one to grow up in. And this is what I did. And so I invite you to be on the team and be part of the process and key into how this process of healing works, what it really means. And the core of the forgiveness process, we're not actually going to get into doing the worksheet tonight, but we're going to get into what the core of the forgiveness process is. And from there, you can tap into, and you know, you can go to our website, or pardon me, to your phone's app store, and just type in the words Heartland, H-E-A-R-T-L-A-N-D, one word, Aramaic, A-R-A-M-A-I-C, forgiveness. And you'll be looking at the world's, as far as I know, only forgiveness app. You can do the worksheet. There are two different versions of it on that, on your phone now, once you download that. And or you can go to whyagain.org, and in the upper left-hand corner of the page, it says start here. Click that button. It'll walk you through literally 50 years of what it took to understand how this process of forgiveness works. And what I'm going to explain to you right now, I didn't understand until I had worked with this for about 35 years. It took that to decode from the Aramaic and come to understand all of the aspects of how this comes together, the physiology, the physics, the psychology, the genetics of it, and how it all works. But suffice to say, in its shortest form at this moment, perception is the output of your mind. It's made of 9 bits of data. If your perception is fueled by any form of hostility or fear, you have a problem because you are suffering from degraded perception. And your life will never go the way you want it to go while your perception is degraded. Underlying degraded perception is generations and generations and generations, pardon me, our generations of unresolved hostility and fear. The thing that drives this whole process, and you'll notice in your life in general, I mean, unless you're just a naturally nasty person, excuse me. If your persona is that degraded that you're a naturally nasty person, you'll notice that as long as everybody's doing what you want them to do, you're a pretty happy camper. But when someone, yourself or someone else, is not fulfilling a goal that you hold for them, that's when you go into hostility and fear, degraded perception, and untoward behavior. Why? Well, how does all that work? Well, here's what happens. Obviously, if there are 10,000 brain cells firing, and this is the most quoted piece of psychological research, and was done back in the 60s, if I remember correctly, this is the most quoted piece of research in psychological history. 9 bits of data, 10,000 brain cells fired. Now, there's other research that's come up since then that says, no, it's 13, it's 12. It doesn't matter. The point is, we get to see a little tiny fragment of what's really going on within us. And obviously, something has to determine which 9 bits of data your mind is going to use to build your perception. Something has to make that determination. What is it? The driver for that whole process is your goals. When you load a goal in the mind through resonance, everything associated with the frequency of that goal. Remember, everything is frequency. You know, I actually don't speak words. I've never spoken a word in my life, and neither of you. We call it words, but actually, I have a little flap of skin in my throat, and I know how to blow air over it so that it creates these things that we call words. But what's really happening is this air moving out causes air molecules to move. The air molecules moving cause a little drum inside of your ear to move, and that drum moving sets up an electrical frequency, and nothing is communicated by that except frequency. No light, no sound, no nothing goes in there or here. What goes in is frequency. And then that frequency causes brain cells to fire. And now your whole history, including your whole genetic history through the last 1,000 generations, is set into activity through the law of resonance. Whatever that goal resonates in you is going to be the information that is recruited by that goal to produce the perception, which includes attitudes and your behaviors. If you don't like the behavior that you're doing, you know, we hear about the alcoholic that got drunk and did crazy stuff. And the next morning when they wake up, they are so repentant. Oh, that's so terrible. I will never do that again. And they really mean they're never going to do it again. But guess what? Next time they get drunk, they'll do it again. Remember we talked about inhibitors earlier? What's the first thing that happens with alcohol? Excessive amounts of alcohol knock out inhibitors. And now all the generational patterns that were never allowed, they were always shut down, they were always inhibited, will come into play and people do crazy stuff. And much as they feel sorry the next morning and swear they're never going to do it, unless they go in and clean up these generational patterns, they're going to do it the next time the circumstance warrants it. Warrants it. And so goals are the driver for this process of billions of bits of information moving in the world, billions of bits moving in us, and 9 bits end up producing the world we experience, the thoughts we think, the feelings we feel, and the energy we engage in. And this process is designed to be fueled by active present love. That's the power supply that it's designed to work with. Now, does anybody have a device in your home, your office, your shop, your car, your business that works really well when you unplug it? No. Human perception is designed to be fueled by human life. It's designed to be fueled by active present love. If your perception is fueled by hostility or fear, then you're not even human. Just because one has a human form does not mean they are human. Remember holding the newborn? Go back and hold that newborn child. Notice when you hold the newborn, what serenity, what peace, what sweetness, what the presence of love is like. Then ask yourself a question. Is the newborn loving me? Or is the newborn love? My offering is, the newborn is the active presence of love, and so are you. If the active presence of love isn't active in your physiology, then there's no human life, because it is love that is human life. Remember Yeshua said, I come to bring you life? You look at his whole body of work, and the whole thing is about how do you get rid of the hostility or fear, and how do you fuel your mind by the active presence of love. Now, it's a two-part process. One part of the process is the dissolution of the generational patterns that do not belong. That's called forgiveness. Forget about ever forgiving anybody ever again. And it always amazes me because I've had people who have been around my work 10, 15, 20 years, and they'll still talk about how well I forgave them. Stop. Never forgive anybody for anything. If you choose to pardon someone, you know, they did something crazy, and you go, I can let that go. I'm going to let it go. I'll pardon you. I'll let you off the hook for that. That's done. But if you call that forgiveness, you won't actually do the next level, which is go inside yourself and remove and clean up the untoward energies that never belong within a human structure. So forgiveness is about the removal of what never belonged. That's half of the process. And the other half of the process is the integration of active love into every cell. To literally create a space in this form where love actively shows up in physiology. Now, the short form of the forgiveness process, and again, please use the radio show, ask questions. The short form of the forgiveness process is, the word forgive in Aramaic is shebag, and it literally translates from Aramaic to cancel. Now, what is it that I cancel? Do I cancel you? Well, that's murder. Probably not a good idea. Do I cancel myself? Well, no, that's suicide. Let's let that one go. But what in every circumstance where I have upset or discernments going on, that means there's an untoward energy moving in my physiology. If I'm going to come out of my denial, what is it that I can cancel to change that whole process? When I cancel my goal, the perception generated as a result of that goal collapses. When it collapses, I now have a clean and open space within my mind where these underlying energies can surface. Because when I cancel a goal and collapse a perception, what happens is a pathway is open into the unconscious or the dissociated content. And what I've dissociated from, depending on my level of willingness, what I've dissociated from will start to come upward to awareness. Now, when I say awareness, it might just be awareness of the energy moving. And it might be specific memories of things that have happened. It's not necessary to go back and remember each dark, dirty, nasty thing that happened in your life. And it's not about laying on the couch and, you know, examining what happened for 30 years until you find that thing. It's about living in and as the active presence of love, making a commitment to that. And as you walk through life, the next piece of work you're ready to do, resonance will bring somebody to you that will resonate what you need to deal with. If you keep it hidden, then you'll only get this surface projection and you'll think it's somebody else. When you cancel the goal, you collapse that perception. It took me 35 years to learn this piece of information. And I understand why the Greeks turned it into pardoning, letting other people off the hook. I understand it fully, because until you've got all these pieces, you know the physics, you know the physiology, you know the high energy, until you put all those pieces together, canceling a perfectly good goal does not make any sense at all. Gee, I just want that person to cherish me. And they're raging at me. Why would I cancel my need to be cherished? Because I'm in terror. Oh, so my physiology is producing terror because I want to be cherished. Oh, so Michael, what you're saying is what you now understand about me is that in my file on being cherished, there's terror. Oh, okay, I see. So if I cancel my goal for them to cherish me, my projection on them collapses and it opens a pathway into all this terror that's stored within my brain cell structure and maybe the terror that's stored from 30 generations ago that needs to be unwound. Oh, now I'm starting to see what forgiveness is as I cancel the goal. Now, I have a 9-bit processor, who we're going to call it for the sake of whatever term we're going to use. If I've got something that's been going on in my bloodline for 25 or 200 generations, and I can process 9 bits at a time, what chance do I have? It's impossible. I mean, it's silly to even try. Fortunately, this man Yeshua understood another major piece of information. And that was that at creation, there was a power put in us that in Aramaic was called Ruach HaKodesh. The Greeks translated these words as the Holy Spirit. Nothing about a disembodied spirit being in the term Ruach HaKodesh in Aramaic. In Aramaic, those terms speak of a feminine elemental force in us that undoes the effects of our errors and teaches us the truth. So when I become willing enough, I will literally, I mean, one of my best examples for, I don't know, 35 years or more. If you were in my workshop 35 years, or, well, 15 years ago, these weren't the words at the top of the board. This word was suppressed. Literally, as I'm sitting and I'm making some changes to the worksheet, the one you see on the website now or in the app is probably at least version 3020, I was sitting doing some work with it, and literally I'm told inside my head, Michael, it's not suppression. That's not clear enough. It's dissociation. What do you mean dissociation? It's not just that you've hidden it away. It's that it's no longer yours. It's gone. You can't change it. When you understand that denial, thinking or speaking as though something outside of you is the cause of this that's in you, then you have to believe that, hide the real process that's happening inside of you. This genius, Yeshua, genius. I mean, how did he come up with this? I don't know. But here's what he showed us. Cancel the goal. Collapse the perception. Perception drops in on its root. You've now got access to the hidden part of your mind. Bring it forward in the presence of love, and then there's a super processor that is available to you. In Aramaic, it was called Ruach HaKodesh. She, a feminine elemental force in us that undoes the effects of our errors and teaches us the truth. So at the point where I cancel the goal and collapse, I may open so much that I'm so overwhelmed. This is part of the whole flood idea. You know, I'm so overwhelmed. There's just so much to move. How do I do it? I connect with Ruach. What is Ruach? In the original Aramaic, they never said anything about God sending out his spirit. What it says is the Creator sent out his breath. We have access to this phenomenal super processor called Ruach HaKodesh. She will, if you invite her to, undo the effects of your errors and teach you the truth. Now, if you've still got a use for one in your lives, well, I just want to keep this little bit of hostility back here so I don't need to protect myself, then she's not going to touch your hostility. It's yours. Hang out with it all you need, all you want. But when you really just surrender, when you're ready to really let it all go, she will process you right down to your genetic toast.